White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. This is episode 33 tonight. It's February 7th, 2013, and I am Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hatting Scott.
And we are here to give you another exciting evening of an hour of learning about what Henry Ford and his writers discovered about the Jews. And now we're in America and in New York, and we're in the theater district tonight. We're going to get into how the Jews took over our theater along with everything else. And also, Hatting, you know, as we mentioned to each other right before the show, this is chapter 28. It's not the longest chapter we have, and we may very well read a portion of chapter 29 also, which is more about the theater, so they just blend together very well.
Okay.
So you just go ahead and get us started.
All right. So we're talking here about how the Jews have taken over the entertainment industry in the United States and what that means. Chapter 28, Jewish Control of the American Theater. The theater has long been a part of the Jewish program for the guidance of public taste and the influencing of the public mind. Not only is the theater given a special place in the program of the protocols, but it is the instant ally, night by night and week by week, of any idea which the power behind the scenes wishes to put forth. It is not by accident that in Russia, where they, which evidently means the Russians and the other nationalities that are not Jews. It is not by accident that in Russia, where they now have scarcely anything else, they still have the theater, specially revived, stimulated, and supported by Jewish Bolshevists, because they believe in the theater just as they believe in the press. It is one of the two great means of molding popular opinions.
Well, we can be sure that our television will never be interrupted, right? No matter what happens, how bad things get, they will make sure that the people are getting the messages on their television screens, right?
That seems like a reasonable inference, yeah.
Right.
You know, I've read that when they have insurrections going on in Gaza, they put pornography on the TV.
Well, I've read that too. I just find that just... That's just, ugh. I use not even a word for that.
Yeah. How about Jewish?
Yeah. Oh, that should be better known, you know. But it was put around quite a bit at that one time.
Everybody has assumed offhand that the theater is Jew-controlled. Few, if put to the test, could prove it. But all believe it. The reason they believe it is not so much what they see as what they feel. The American feel has gone out of the theater. A dark, oriental atmosphere has come instead. Not only the legitimate stage, so-called, but the motion picture industry, the fifth greatest of the great industries, is also Jew-controlled. Not in spots only, not 50% merely, but entirely, with the natural consequence that now the world is in arms against the trivializing and demoralizing influences of that form of entertainment as at present managed. And of course there was this made-for-TV documentary movie called Hollywoodism that aired in 1998. That showed that Hollywood was created by Jews and really essentially owned by Jews. That was based on a book called An Empire of Their Own by Neil Gabler, who is also a Jew. Jews used to deny that Hollywood was Jewish, but, you know, I mean, I think Marlon Brando got into some hot water when he said that Hollywood was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, they've started openly admitting and even bragging about it.
And, you know, it's interesting that in 1920, it was already the fifth greatest of all the great industries. And they're not talking about theater, but I don't know if they're combining the two, the motion picture industry, the fifth largest, they use the word greatest, of all the large industries. That's pretty amazing at that time.
Yeah.
Now it must be, what would it be now?
It's huge because they sell all over the world.
Yes, right.
Although a German friend of mine says that Hollywood is in decline as a global influence.
Well, we hope so.
As soon as the Jew gained control of American liquor, we had a liquor problem with drastic consequences. As soon as the Jew gained control of the movies, we had a movie problem, the consequences of which are not yet visible. It is the genius of that race to create problems of a moral character in whatever business they achieve a majority. Every night, hundreds of thousands of people give from 2 to 3 hours to the theater. Every day, literal millions of people give up from 30 minutes to 2 hours to the movies. And this simply means that millions of Americans every day place themselves voluntarily within range of Jewish ideas of life, love, and labor, within range of Jewish propaganda, sometimes cleverly, sometimes clumsily concealed. This gives the Jewish masseur of the public mind all the opportunity he desires, and his only protest now is that exposure may make his game a trifle difficult.
Now, I thought that was just an amazing paragraph there, so pertinent to today, so prescient, now we can say that people are spending 7 and 8 hours in front of the television, taking in all this, what they call Jewish ideas of life and love and labor, et cetera. And the Jewish masseur of the public mind, oh, man, that's a good phrase to use for television. That was really good. So they already felt that going on then. It's only gotten worse. I don't know. Must have been pretty bad then.
Oh, yeah. A lot more people are seeing their productions and for more hours every day, almost constantly, really. And then you've got to figure in popular music, and Walkmans or whatever they use now, iPods.
Yeah, everything. You know. Everything is. And no wonder the Judaization has gone so deep, and we find it in ourselves, you know, in things that we don't even think about until it would come up, where it came from and why it's there and why we have these ideas. Pretty amazing. In the theater, some of the people listening, younger people, need to understand that theater back then, live theater, was more people went to it than you might think. You know, nobody goes hardly now, you know, only in major cities, and still not, it's not that big. Yeah. But then it was, there were all these matinees, and if they didn't go to the theater, they read about it, you know, and they knew about what the plays were and the actors and actresses and all of that. So,
yeah, the live theater today is for the hoity-toity.
Yeah.
But back then that was equivalent to movies.
Yeah.
In large part, still.
But as soon as the movies came, people liked the movies.
Yeah. The theater is Jewish not only on its managerial side, but also on its literary and professional side. More and more plays are appearing whose author, producer, star, and cast are entirely Jewish. They are not great plays, but Oh, wait. They are not great plays. They do not remain long. This is natural enough, since the Jewish theatrical interests are not seeking artistic triumphs. They are not seeking the glory of the American stage. Nor are they striving to develop great actors to take the place of the old line of worthies. Not at all. Their interest is financial and racial. Their interest is financial and racial. Getting the Gentiles money and Judaizing the theater. There is a tremendous Judaizing movement on. The work is almost complete. Boastful articles are already beginning to appear in the Jewish press, which is always a sign.
I thought this was amazing here, using the term Judaizing. For some reason, yeah. I thought that was a more modern term, but here they're using it. This is so, could have been written yesterday about the movies.
Well, I think that term Judaizing has been used in a religious context for probably a lot longer than 100 years ago.
Yeah, but they're not using it in the religious context.
Well, it has about roughly the same meaning.
Yeah.
Gentile attendants on the theater are frequently insulted to their faces and never know it. Recently, one of the best-known Jewish entertainers on the stage indulged in a vulgar and sacrilegious reference... Recently, one of the best-known Jewish entertainers on the stage indulged in vulgar and sacrilegious references to Jesus Christ, whereat the Semitic portions of his audiences went into loud laughter, while the Gentiles sat blank-faced, because the remarks were in Yiddish asides.
Terrible.
I read the first sentence of that paragraph about how Gentile attendants at the theater are frequently insulted to their faces and never... Uh-huh. I started thinking about examples from popular entertainment where the Jews spit in our eye and people laugh at it anyway.
Oh, yeah, sickening. It's sickening. When I see clips like at comedy clubs or something, I don't know, hardly ever do that anymore, but it comes to my mind that these comedians are saying things that are so insulting to white people or to Christian people or whatever, and all these people in the audience who are those kind of people feel like they have to be good-natured, you know, and not, they don't want to be prudes or take offense, and they're laughing and, look, sometimes looking a little uncomfortable, but, you know, mostly it's just, God, it's just what's been done to us in the idea of, accepting everything, you know, in this modern society where there's freedom of speech and so on. Anyway.
Well, you're talking about overtly anti-white content that people laugh at anyway. White people laugh at it anyway.
Yeah.
They accept it. There's also a lot that's not so obvious, too.
Well, this one, what they say here certainly wasn't. It was things said in Yiddish. But I don't know exactly what example you have in mind.
Well, I'm thinking about Bugs Bunny.
Okay. Well, what does he do?
Who are the villains in the Bugs Bunny cartoon?
Gosh, I haven't seen one for so long. Let's see. Who are they?
Yosemite Sam.
Oh, yeah. Elmer
Fudd.
Yeah.
Now, what is Yosemite Sam?
Elmer Fudd. Oh, yeah. Elmer Fudd's after because Bugs is in his garden. Okay.
Hmm?
Oh. Bugs is in his garden. That's why Elmer Fudd is after him.
Well, Elmer Fudd, there's one episode of Bugs Bunny where Elmer Fudd sings Wagner. Okay. Kill the rabbit, kill the rabbit, kill the...
I don't know that.
Oh, yeah. Elmer Fudd is supposed to be a German.
Yeah.
And Yosemite Sam is an American redneck.
Yeah.
Bugs Bunny is a Jew.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Okay, are people supposed to know that? I mean, people don't know that. But you're saying that that's the message that we're getting?
I'm saying that's the subtext to it.
Okay.
All right.
You have to write about that. Have you ever written a story about that?
I've never written about it.
You need to do that.
Yeah. It's a surmise, anyway. Okay. Let's see. Time after time, the Jewish entertainer did that thing, and it was very plain to one who knew that the Jewish portion of the audience was enjoying the insults to the Gentiles much more than they were enjoying the well-worn humor of the entertainer's remarks. It was a great thing for them that in several important American cities they could see and hear being done under cover, and to American Gentiles, what is being done openly to Russian Gentiles. In the audiences referred to, there was probably $4,500 to $5,000 in gate money represented. Of this, the Jews present, at the very highest estimate, could not have contributed more than $500. That's 1/9 to 1/10. Yet the Jewish star several times slapped the religious sensibilities of the major portion of his audience under cover of Yiddish. The theater is felt by him and his ilk to be a Jewish institution. Down to 1885, the American theater was still in the hands of the Gentiles. From 1885 dates the first invasion of Jewish influence. It meant the parting of the ways, and the future historian of the American stage will describe that year with the word Ichabod. That year marks not only the beginning of the Jewish wedge of control, but something far more important.
You know, I didn't see Ichabod repeated further along in this, so I was going to look it up, and I forgot to do that. So what does that mean? Why is that used there?
I don't know.
Oh, well, we both failed to check that out. Okay.
It is not important that managers are now Jews, whereas managers were formerly Gentiles. That is not important. The important begins with the fact that the change of managers there came also, with the change of managers, there came also a decline in the art and morals of the stage, and that this decline has become accelerated as the Jewish control became widened. What Jewish control means is this, that everything has been deliberately and systematically squeezed out of the American theater, except its most undesirable elements. And these undesirable elements have been exalted to the highest place of all. The great age of the American theater is past. About the time that Jewish control appeared, Sheridan, Sothern, McCulloch, Madame Janáušek, Mary Anderson, Frank Mayo, John T. Raymond began to pass off the stage. It was natural that, life being brief, they should pass at last, but the appalling fact began to be apparent that they had left no successors. Why? Because a Hebrew hand was on the stage, and the natural genius of the stage was no longer welcomed. A new form of worship was to be established. And that's not really entirely a metaphor. I think I've mentioned in an earlier show that we did that the drama began as a form of, as an element of religious worship.
Uh-huh.
It was
that's
a religious...
right. You have. And now they oh, I see. Now it's going to be the worship of what the Jews want to
Shakespeare spells ruin, was the utterance of a Jewish manager. Highbrow stuff is also a Jewish expression. These two sayings, one appealing to the managerial end, the other to the public end of the theater, have formed the epitaph of the classic era. All that remained after the Hebrew hand fell across the stage were a few artists who had received their training under the Gentile school. Julia Marlowe, Tyrone Power, R.D. McLean, and a little later, Richard Mansfield, Robert Mantell, E.H. Sothern. Two of this group remain, and with Maud Adams, they constitute the last flashings of an era that has gone, an era that apparently leaves no great exemplars to perpetuate it. The present-day average of intelligence appealed to in the American theater does not rise above 13 to 18 years. The tired businessman stuff, another Jewish expression, has treated the theater-going public as if it were composed of morons. Hmm. The appeal is, frankly, to a juvenile mind, a juvenile type of mind, which can be easily molded to the ideals of the Hebraic theatrical monopoly. Clean, wholesome plays, the few that remain, are supported mainly by the rapidly vanishing race of theatergoers who survived from an earlier day. The present generation has been educated by the narrowed compass of modern dramatic themes to support plays of an entirely different type. Tragedy is taboo. The play of character with a deeper significance than would delight the mind of a child is out of favor. The comic opera has degenerated into a flash of color and movement, a combination of salacious farce and jazz music, usually supplied by a Jewish songwriter, the great purveyors of jazz. And the rage is for extravaganza and burlesque. Now, that was an interesting statement there, that tragedy is taboo. And I can think that a reason why tragedy might be taboo, if you get the definition of tragedy from Aristotle, tragedy is always about superior human beings who fail in spite of their merits. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the Jews want to portray superior human beings that are really superior human beings. They also don't want to, I think, portray a kind of tragic outlook on life where you recognize that the people who are fortunate in life may not deserve their good fortune and that the good guys can lose. Because, you see, the Jews believe that, or try to maintain that they have what they call the just world hypothesis. Yeah. Where, you know, if you won in the end, it's because you deserve to win. It's also called the Whig view of history.
Right. Well, you know, I was thinking, too, that they kind of invented a new kind of tragedy in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Of the Jewish hero, who's the same kind of a hero, but I'm thinking of Arthur Miller's play. What was that famous play of his?
Death of a Salesman.
Yeah, was that it? Death of a Salesman, with that man who's and then all this stuff was all written by Jews that they put on the stage by then. And it kind of featured the whole Jewish themes and Jewish heroes and heroines, even if they were sometimes disguised. And then we're going to come up to Ben-Hur here, and that's another one.
The modern bedroom farce has been exalted into the first place. With the exception of Ben-Hur, which is favored by Jewish producers, apparently because it holds before the public a romantic picture of a Jew, a very un-Jewish Jew, by the way, the historical drama has given way to fleshly spectacles set off with overpowering scenic effects, the principal component of which is an army of girls, mostly Gentiles, whose investment of drapery does not exceed 5 ounces in weight.
You know, I don't know if this is the place to talk about that. I don't know. He goes into Ben-Hur a little bit more, I think, later in the next chapter. Not too much, though. So I thought, you know, I was looking up Ben-Hur because I remembered this big movie, you know, it was actually 1960. It won these Academy Awards, came out in 1950-something. And I thought, well, what do they know about it? You know, but then there was an earlier one. And also, this novel was written in 1880, mm-hmm. Ben-Hur, A Tale of Christ. See, I didn't know any of this. And it was considered the most influential Christian book of the 19th century. And it was written by a Christian man, not super Christian, but, you know, not a Jew. But I guess the Jews saw the potential in it. And so it became, the book was, of course, bestseller, so they take advantage of that. It superseded Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was written in 1852 and had been the highest-selling book. And then it remained at the top from 1880 until 1936, when it was beat by Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind.
Uh-huh.
And then following release of their 1959 MGM film adaptation of Ben-Hur, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, it was seen by tens of millions, won 11 Academy Awards, and book sales surpassed Gone with the Wind. And it was the book, and the whole story was even blessed by Pope Leo the 13th.
Yeah.
And the story is basically one in which a first century Jew becomes a Christian after witnessing the crucifixion of Christ.
Uh-huh.
And, the hero is this Judah Ben-Hur, a Jewish prince and merchant. Well, I don't need to read all of that. But, supposedly it all happened at the same time. And so then they turn, they've made it into a great story about a heroic Jew. But yet at the same time, at this time, they had a Jew. The Jew had to become a Christian, And so that's a little bit of but it worked for them because they say that it's one of the most pro-Semitic things that ever took place in America was Ben-Hur.
Yeah, but it has the Jew becoming a Christian. encouraging the Christian Zionist pipe dream of having all the Jews convert to Christianity.
Oh, yeah, very Christian Zionist, the whole thing, but it wasn't intended, I guess, in the beginning. This guy just thought he was writing an interesting story.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Any Jew that could be played by Charlton Heston is not very Jewish, I think.
Well, the story isn't very Jewish. It's just...
And then he converts to Christianity at the end, which is, I don't know, there must be some Orthodox Jews that just hate that story. Frivolities.
Well, not Hollywood. They didn't hate it.
Yeah. Frivolity, sensuality, indecency, appalling illiteracy, and endless platitude are the marks of the American stage as it approaches its degeneracy under Jewish control. That, of course, is the real meaning of all the little theater movements, which have begun in so many cities and towns in the United States. The art of the drama, having been driven out of the theater by the Jews, is finding a home in thousands of study circles throughout the United States. The people cannot see the real plays, therefore they read them. The plays that are acted could not be read at all, for the most part, any more than the words of the jazz songs can be read. They don't mean anything. The people who want to see the real plays and cannot, because Jewish producers won't produce them, are forming little dramatic clubs of their own in barns and churches, in schools and neighborhood halls. The drama fled from its exploiters and has found a home with its friends. The changes which the Jews have made in the theater, and which any half-observant theater-goer can verify with his own eyes, are four in number. First, they have elaborated the mechanical side, making human talent and genius less necessary. And I want to comment here. This is actually a general tendency of capitalism, to try to minimize the human element in production.
Oh, sure, it's more cost efficient.
Yeah, that's what it signals, is that money has become the completely overriding purpose of the whole thing. It's all about making as much money as possible. Mm-hmm. There's no, it's not being run by people that just love drama
Well, but they say that they can lower prices and make more things available to more people, which has some truth in it. But yeah, but it changes the whole way of life that we have.
They have made the stage realistic instead of interpretative. The great actors needed very little machinery. The men and women on the payrolls of the Jewish managers are helpless without the machinery. The outstanding fact about the vast majority of present-day performances of any pretension is that the mechanical part dwarfs and obscures the acting, however good. And this is the reason. Knowing that good actors are growing scarce, knowing that the Jewish policy is death to talent, knowing perhaps most keenly of all that good actors constitute a running charge on his revenue, the Jewish producer prefers to put his faith and his money in wood, canvas, paint, cloth, and tinsel, of which scenery and costumes are made. Wood and paint never show contempt for his sordid ideals and his betrayal of his trust.
Well, sometimes these guys really show how angry they are and how much they dislike the Jew and what they've done and so on.
Oh, yeah. And thus we have, when we go to the theater today, bursts of color, ruffles of lace and linen, waving lines and dazzling effects of light and motion, but no ideas. A great many stage employees, but very few actors. There are drills and dances without end, but no drama.
Well, they should see the special effects film that we have today that started even 20 years ago.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah.
There's some real crappy movies. They have all these obnoxious noises and special effects. You know, just bore me to death.
Me too.
That is one influence on the American theater which the Jew claims, and the credit for which can be given him in full. He has put in the iridescence, but he has taken out the profounder ideas. He has placed the American public in the position of being able to remember the names of plays without being able to recall what composed them, like the Floradora girls, a Jewish creation. We remember the name of the group, but not of any individual in it. The Jew has done this to perfection, but no one will contend that it represents a forward step. Taken by and large, it is part of a very serious and harmful retrogression.
And look at how they've gotten all of our youth and people to just love to go to movies that the most special effects they have, you know, the more popular they are, and they think that's just great. So talk about, you know, and this is all the Jews behind this.
Yeah, you also have a lot of entertainers today that are really not particularly talented. They've been made by publicity.
Yes. Yeah.
Second, the Jews may be credited also with having introduced Oriental sensuality to the American stage. Not even the most ardent Jewish defender will deny this, for the thing is there before the eyes of all who will see. Little by little, the mark of the filthy tide has risen against the walls of the American theater, until now it is all but engulfed. It is a truism that there is more unrefined indecency in the higher class theaters today than was ever permitted by the police in the burlesque houses. The lower classes must be restrained in the vicarious exercise of their lower natures, apparently. But the wealthier classes may go to the limit. The price of the ticket and the class of the playhouse seems to make all the difference in the world between prohibited and permissible evil.
This brings up, in my mind, when we hear about these elaborate sex and drug parties in mansions, you know, that are politicians and judges and people high up like that are invited to and encouraged to attend. That's fine for them. You know, who God knows what goes on in those places, in those parties, all kinds of things, even supposedly child sex and so on. But that's all right for them. But then, you know, the ordinary people are held to a higher standard.
The decadent rich.
Yeah.
In New York, where Jewish managers are thicker than they ever will be in Jerusalem, the limit of the theatrical adventuresomeness into the realm of the forbidden is being pushed further and further. Last season's spectacle of Aphrodite seemed to be deliberately designed as a frontal attack on the last entrenched scruple of moral conservatism. The scenes are most oriental in their voluptuous abandonment. Men in breech clouts, leopard skins and buckskins, women in flimsy gowns of gossamer texture slashed to the hips, with very little besides, make a bewildering pageant whose capstone was the unveiling of a perfectly nude girl whose body had been painted to resemble marble. Save that it was all designed and all put through on schedule, it was almost the limit to which such exhibitions could go in real life. Its promoter, of course, was a Jew. As an entertainment, it was infantile. The splendor of its insinuations, the daring of its situations, were the fruitage of long study of the art of seducing the popular mind.
I like that.
It was said when Aphrodite first appeared that the police had moved against it, but some held that this was a clever press agent stunt to excite public interest in the promised pruriency. It was also said that even had the police interference been the genuine result of outraged official minds, the fact that the Jews of New York are represented in the judiciary out of all proportion to their numbers would have rendered the Jewish producer free from interference. In any event, the piece was not molested. The sale of narcotics is illegal, but the instilling of insidious moral poison is not. The whole loose atmosphere of cabaret and midnight frolic entertainment is of Jewish origin and importation. Mention the best known and the worst known. They are all Jewish. The runway down which less than half-dressed girls cavort, fluttering their loose finery in the faces of the spectators, is an importation from Vienna, but a Jewish creation. The abuses of the runway will not bear description here. The Paris boulevards and Montmartre have nothing at all in the nature of lascivious entertainment that New York cannot duplicate. But neither New York nor any other American city has that comédie française which strives to counterbalance the evil of Paris. Where have the writers for the stage a single chance in this welter of sensuousness? Where have the actors of tragic or comic talent a chance in such productions? It is the age of the chorus girl, a creature whose mental caliber has nothing to do with the matter, and whose stage life cannot, in the very nature of things, be a career. It is only occasionally that a great writer for the stage, a Shaw, a Masefield, a Barry, an Ibsen, or any Gentile writer of merit, is permitted to get as far as actual production, and then only for a short period. The stream of colored electric lighting effects, of women and tinsel, closes in behind them, and they are washed away to survive in printed books among those who still know what the theater ought to be.
And then all these young women that are, you know, that they use in all these productions and so on.
Yeah.
You know, to them, it's an opportunity of a lifetime, you know. To them, it's this great opportunity to make money and not to be in some drudgy job or something. And You know, so they're also, and they often get, they're often harmed by their exposure to all this show business that they get into. Because they're nobody, really. And after they're being used for a while and misused, well, then they don't have much to look forward to.
I'm sure. I'm sure the casting couch didn't start with Hollywood.
No.
A third consequence of Jewish domination of the American stage has been the appearance of the New York Star System. New York Star System, with its advertising appliances. The last few years of the theater have been marked by numerous stars that really never rose and certainly never shone, but which were hoisted high on the advertising walls of the Jewish theatrical syndicates in order to give the public the impression that these feeble lantern lights were in the highest heaven of dramatic achievement. In other words, these were no talents that had been created through publicity.
Right.
The trick is a department store trick. It is sheer advertising strategy. The stars of yesterday, who did not even survive yesterday, were either the personal favorites of managers or goods taken off the shelf and heaped into the window for the sake of giving the appearance of a new stock. In brief, whereas in normal times the public made the star by their acclaim, nowadays the Jewish managers determine by their advertisements who the star shall be. The New York stamp, which frequently means nothing at all, is the one imperial sign of favor, according to the Jewish theatrical hierarchy. It is just this New York stamp that the rest of the country protests against, and the little theater movement throughout the West and Central West is a significant protest. A Mary Anderson or a Julia Marlowe would be impossible under the Jewish system. They were disciples of art who later became artists and then were rightly acclaimed as stars. But their development was a tedious process. Their fame was based on the rising approval of the people, year after year. These actresses put in season after season, traveling the same circuit, learning little by little, rounding out their work. They did not have, nor did they seek, the New York stamp. They worked first for the approval of the people of the provinces, which is the contemptuous Jewish term for the rest of the United States, I guess what they now call flyover country.
Yeah.
There was, however, no Jewish dictatorship of the theater when Mary Anderson and Julia Marlowe were building their art and careers, which throws a light on the reason for there being no Mary Andersons or Julia Marlowe's coming up to the succession. The Jew seeks immediate success in all but racial affairs. In this breakdown of the Gentile theater, the process cannot be too swift for him. The training of artists takes time. It is far simpler to have the advertising bills serve as a substitute, and, as the itinerant faker dentist had a brass band blare loud enough to drown the anguished cries of his victims, so the Jewish manager seeks to divert attention from the dramatic poverty of the theater by throwing confetti, limbs, lingerie, and spangles dazzlingly into the eyes of his audience. These three results of Jewish control in the theater are all explained by a fourth. The secret of the serious change which has occurred since 1885 is found in the Jewish tendency to commercialize everything it touches. The focus of attention has been shifted from the stage to the box office. The banal policy of give the public what they want is the policy of the panderer, and it entered the American theater with the first Jewish invasion. About 1885, two alert Jews established in New York a so-called booking agency and offered to take over the somewhat cumbersome system by which managers of theaters in St. Louis, Detroit, or Omaha arranged engagements of attractions for their houses for the ensuing season. The old process involved extensive correspondence with producing managers in the East, and many local managers were obliged to spend several months in New York to make up a season's bookings. The advantages were that the booking agency, supplied with a list of the open dates of the houses they represented, were able to lay out a complete season's itinerary or route for a traveling company, and enabled the producer of a play to spend his vacation at the seashore instead of passing the sultry mid-season in New York, while the local manager was saved the trouble of much writing or even a trip east, and was content to let the booking concern attend to all details and send him his next season's bookings when completed. In this manner was laid the foundation of the latter-day theatrical trust. The booking firm was that of Claw and Erlanger. The former, a young Jew from Kentucky who had studied law, but drifted into theatrical life as an agent. The latter, a young Jew from Cleveland, with little education, but with experience as an advance agent.
Let me just put in here that this Erlanger was Abraham A. Erlanger, whose name was the first name on the credits of the film, the 1925 film, the original one, Ben-Hur, under it was right under Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. So he obviously had the, you know, whatever, he had the say-so about that.
Yeah, so he moved from live theater bookings into the movie industry.
Right, he did. And, fact, big time, he's very well known, and he produced dozens of Broadway shows during the first decades of the 20th century. Well, including, I guess these were Broadway shows too, Dracula, Ben-Hur, and The Jazz Singer. Or does that mean he produced them as movies, maybe? I don't know what it means, but anyway, that's a little tidbit from his.
Well, it's pretty obvious when the movies replaced live theater that, whoever had been, arranging for the live theaters to have performances could also use the same connections to circulate movies.
Right.
The booking system was not of their devising. They borrowed the idea from Harry C. Taylor, who had established a sort of theatrical exchange where producers and local managers could meet, desks being provided them at a small rental, and who took over the booking in their smaller cities without foreseeing, but probably scorning, the opportunity thus placed in his hands to club the whole theatrical world into submission with his dictates. With characteristic shrewdness, Claw and Erlanger elaborated the idea they had borrowed from Taylor, opened competition against the latter, and enlisted the support of a number of young Jewish advance agents who were beginning to recognize the lucrative opportunities which the theatrical profession afforded. Prominent among their earliest supporters was Charles Frohman, employed by J. H. Haverly. His brother, Daniel, had been business manager for the Mallorys at the Madison Square Theater since 1881. And though the Frohmans stand out in relief from the background of the Polish-Jewish influence on the theater, they found it to their advantage to cooperate with the booking firm and subsequently became prominent members of the Trust. Capital T there, the Trust. The establishment of the Jewish booking agency system is the key to the whole problem of the decline of the American stage. The old booking system had the enormous advantage of the personal touch in the relationship between manager and company, and made possible the development of genius in accordance with the organic laws which determine its nurture, growth, and fruition. Except in its highest form, acting is not an art, but heaven-born genius is no more vocal in an Edwin Booth, without long training, than a Bonaparte is necessarily a world conqueror without the technique of the artillery school. These two thoughts have the utmost bearing on giving the Jews the control of the theater. There being no syndicate, no pooling among the Gentile managers of the 1880s, they presented their stars or other attractions at rival theaters in competition as individual offerings, and at the end of a reasonable New York run, not forced for road consumption, took their companies on a tour of the country. The manager's whole investment was probably tied up in his enterprise. He thus became a part of his group of artists, sharing their hardships of travel, their joys and sorrows. If business was good, they shared the satisfaction. If otherwise, it was sink or swim for one as well as the other. In those days, much was heard about troops traveling on their trunks, on their luggage. In other words, the stories were not exaggerated, but life had its better side too. The manager and the actor were daily companions. There was a mutual absorption of ideas. The manager learned to know and appraise the artistic temperament, which is a tangible asset when not a form of artificial grouch or congenital ill nature, and to respect the actor's point of view, while reciprocally, the actor was able to place himself in the manager's position and to get his point of view from close personal affiliation. Okay.
Yeah, that's the end of chapter 28 in the issue Dearborn Independent of January 1st, 1921. Now we've moved, you see, to 1921, first day of the year there. And now the next one, we've still got enough time to start this, and I think we should because it kind of just flows. They kind of turned this into two chapters, I think.
Yeah.
Because it was so long and so much to say. All right. You want to start this one? And we'll just see. We talked a little bit about Ben-Hur, too.
Okay, I'll read it really fast. Okay. chapter 29. The Rise of the First Jewish Theatrical Trust. It has long been known among dramatic critics that the reason for the maintenance of Ben-Hur in the theater for 19 years is this. It is the most successful of all the vehicles for pro-Semitism now on the stage. That will appear to be a prejudicial statement in the minds of the thousands who have seen and enjoyed Ben-Hur, but there is truth in it. The point which should not be overlooked, however, is that if Ben-Hur is useful in framing the public mind favorably toward the Jews, it is not because of a pro-Semitic intention in the story. That may be the intention of the producers, Messrs. Klaw and Erlanger, but it was not the intention of General Lew Wallace.
Yeah, now he was the author of the book, and this Erlanger, now we see, was already put it on the stage. He already put Ben-Hur on the stage, and so then when it was made into a movie, of course, he was a top dog there.
Yeah. It would seem that art and fate conspire against the propagandist play, for in no other way can the failure of avowedly pro-Semitic drama be explained. Perhaps there was never such a serious and even strenuous attempt made to force the Jewish-controlled theater into the service of pro-Semitism as has been made in recent months. And the attempts, with one possible exception, have been failures. Lavishly produced, heralded by an unbroken clack of press announcement, swathed in an initial chorus of praise, sponsored by officialdom which had been dragged out to stand godfather to the productions, they nevertheless have failed. Be it said to the credit of the American Jew that he has been one of the causes of the failure. A most significant and hopeful sign was the reaction of the intelligent Jewish community against the attempt to utilize the stage as a hustings to boost the Jew into an unreal eminence and desirability. Certain competent Jews wrote their opinions about this with much freedom and wisdom, and they evinced a spirit which, if it could be made to permeate all Jewish activities, would quickly dispose of the Jewish question under whatever phase it may be considered. It is this spirit of judging Jewish interests in the light of the whole which promises a helpful and lasting solution of all the differences which unfortunately have been permitted to arise between the people of Judah and the others.
So a few Jews spoke out against what they were doing there, and so that gave them hope that, oh, everything was going to change. Well, that didn't happen, did it?
Not really. And it may be that secretly what really irritated them about Ben-Hur is that it has the Jew converting to Christianity.
Sure. Sure, that's where what you said before comes in. That's probably was it. So they didn't want it to become such a big deal, but it was just so popular. Man, that was almost, you know, then in 1959 they made a new version of it. That was, I remember, that was huge. And after that was the Ten Commandments. I don't know which came first, but Ben-Hur, the Ten Commandments. Around that time, they were having all these biblical movies.
Yeah.
Of course, Charles Heston was in all of them, I guess.
The fact of Jewish control of the theater is not of itself a ground for complaint. If certain Jews, working separately or in groups, have succeeded in wrenching this rich business from its former Gentile control, that is purely a matter of commercial interest. It is precisely on the same footing as if one group of Gentiles won the control from another group of Gentiles. It may be regarded as a business matter. In this, as in other business matters, however, there is the ethical test of how the control was gained and how it is used. Society is usually willing to receive the fact of control with equanimity, providing the control is not used for antisocial purposes.
Well, should we stop here?
Yeah, I think that's a good place.
Okay, all right, and stop. And so we will, ladies and gentlemen, be back next week, and we will continue with this. We'll do a little review of what we've already done and then continue on here. And might even get into the next chapter, which is, what did you say it was, Hanny?
Oh, I don't remember now.
Oh, yeah, it was, I don't either. I forgot it. Well, we're about ready for our
next. The next chapter is how Jews capitalized a protest against Jews.
Oh, yeah, that sounds really good.
Oy vey, it's anti-Semitism.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being with us tonight, and come back again next week.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.